From the Sky News Centre at 5, Donald Trump has been accused of being racist by using a derogatory swear word at a meeting.
These are shocking and shameful comments. I'm sorry, but there's no other word one can use but racist.
The UN's human rights spokesperson, Rupert Colville, has condemned the US president after claims he used the language to describe poor countries. Mr. Trump says he used tough words but didn't say the expletive that's being reported. He's also making the headlines after cancelling his trip to the UK to open the new American embassy building. A top surgeon who branded his initials on two unconscious patients' livers has avoided jail. Simon English reports.
How many patients did you do this to, Mr. Brummel?
Mr. Brummel, why are you...
Simon Brummel didn't speak to reporters as he left Birmingham Crown Court. The 53-year-old's been fined £10,000 and given 120 hours unpaid work. In one case in 2013, he boasted to a colleague, "This is what I do," as he used an argon beam to mark a patient. That's a tool used to control bleeding, which leaves a temporary harmless scar. Prosecutors hope the sentence will maintain confidence in the profession.
There is no greater trust than the trust which patients place in surgeons during operations.
Some of Brummel's former patients were in court to support him.
Some breaking news. A huge fire at Nottingham Railway Station this morning is now being treated as arson. Teams are still working to put the blaze out after it started in some toilets and spread to the main concourse and the roof. A woman from the UK is being questioned on suspicion of plotting a terror attack after being arrested at Heathrow Airport. She was detained this morning, coming back from Ethiopia. In sport, two former youth team coaches at Chelsea are denying allegations of racial or other abuse. Former England midfielder Graham Ricks and Gwyn Williams are facing claims relating to the 1990s. And a portrait of Amy Winehouse painted by an artist who met her in a pub is going on sale for £24,000. Dan Llewellyn Hall asked if he could paint the singer in 2009. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. Screen Councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Israeli armed forces launch a series of attacks against not ISIS, but the Syrian Arab Army. What happened exactly? And more to the point, why haven't we heard about this much on the news? Plus infiltration, not just of companies and charities, but any organisation that stands against the New World Order. Well, that's one way of putting it anyway. We hear from the longtime environmental campaigner, now retired and editing FRAC News, Frances Leader, about what she calls the five different types of infiltrators she's come across in her four decades of campaigning. And Britain's greatest war criminal of all time, is it Tony Blair? Back in 2003, singer and musician George Michael had a few things to say about Mr. Blair. Could he even have been something of a prophet of our time? We hear an extract from his appearance on the BBC's Hard Talk show from 2003. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, mainly dry. This weekend is highs of 7, cloudy and breezy tomorrow, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, showers and gales, but also some sunny spells during the week. Next weekend, the 20th and 21st of January, highs of 7 Celsius, more sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Hi, Fee. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Afternoon. I like the comedy music.
The comedy music? Which one?
Yeah, the introductory music. It sounds like clown music.
Does it really?
Yeah,
is
yeah,
that
yeah.
what we are then, do you think?
No, I think it's possibly a reflection of politics, but there we go.
Well, I think you have to laugh at it sometimes, don't you?
Do.
Some of it, you know, and also, yeah, particularly, for example, with the march that we had back in, I think it was in October, with the mayor leading a march against his own cuts. I think that must have been a first.
I think that was well-intentioned. I think there was a certain amount of conflict within the Labour Party. I mean, I'll defer to Martin on that one, I think, but that caused Marvin to lead that one. But certainly, I think it's been a very difficult period.
Martin, what do you make of that? Was there a comic, a surreal aspect to it?
Well, I think it's a perfectly legitimate tactic. I think there are questions if you're going to go to London to meet the government. Either A, you meet the government, or B, you have a press conference when you get there saying they're not going to meet with us. I think that was a missed opportunity. But, I mean, people wanted to demonstrate because they're angry about what's going on, and people needed to express that.
But Fee, recently you've been asked to leave the cabinet. Just take us through that, because it was supposed to be a rainbow cabinet. That's what the Mayor Marvin Rees was elected to do, but that's not ended up like that, has it?
No, it hasn't. And I wasn't actually asked to leave. I was told to leave indirectly. The way it happened
when
was...
When you say indirectly, yeah.
Nope. No,
how do you mean?
Well, Marvin sent an email to Eleanor, who's the leader of the Green Group, on the Wednesday, saying he no longer wished to have a rainbow cabinet. And she sat on this thinking, well, does Fee know about this? Called me in the morning and said, Fee, I've had this odd email from Marvin. Did you know about it? And I said, no. And that was the first I heard that the rainbow cabinet was at an end. So I forwarded it on to him and said, what's going on? When do I take it that I'm now, you know, sacked? When do I stop? And he didn't respond until about 2 minutes before the press release went out, when I got a voicemail on my BlackBerry. But I haven't actually spoken to him since, and neither has he called me.
Oh, okay. So yeah, but have you called him?
Yeah. I called him straight back when I got the voicemail saying, oh, let's talk. When do I finish? Nothing.
Interesting. The wall of silence. Actually, that's what we've been getting here from Marvin Rees. I've been approaching him, this must be around about 10, 15 times now, since he became mayor. And he'd even agreed to come on this programme around about September time. And then just the day before, I phoned the office just to double check. He was due to come in and was told, oh, no, he's too busy, he can't come. I'm getting the same treatment from both the press office and from the mayor's office now, which is just no replies at all. So I can only assume I've been blacklisted. But do you think is that what's going on?
There's a certain degree, I mean, if I'm honest.
Is it incompetence or is it deliberate?
There's a certain degree of chaos in the mayor's office. I mean, he is very busy. He gets lots of invitations, you know, to be fair. However, I think it's fair to say that Marvin is relatively thin-skinned. I mean, given the, you know, the insults and the accusations that were levelled at George Ferguson when he was mayor, and he managed to maintain a cabinet. And ostensibly, myself and Claire Hiscott, the Conservative, we were sacked because Marvin felt the other political parties weren't playing ball and were playing political footballs and all the rest of it. And pretty much everybody was left. Every journalist I spoke to was sitting there going, well, we're scratching our heads rather, working out what the problem was. Because I think that the Green Party certainly, and even the Conservatives, had done their best to work cooperatively and say, yes, this is good, but... And clearly that wasn't enough for Marvin.
So how long were you actually serving on the cabinet for?
I did 6 months with George, and then I did I got sacked at the beginning of December, end of November, so May, it's 18 months with Marvin.
So at least now you're outside the cabinet, you're much freer to speak, I suppose.
Yes, I am. I was absolutely devastated at the time, because you don't do a job like being in the cabinet and have it mean nothing to you, because otherwise it's not worth doing, you know. So I was very committed, and Marvin did say, you know, he's got no complaints about my performance, or indeed Claire Hiscott's, the Conservative, who went at the same time as me. So it was a job that meant a lot, and I was doing energy and waste, which are clearly very green-leaning type subjects, and they meant a great deal, and I'd been doing it for, I don't know, 8, 9 months, something like that. So to have the rug pulled out from under your feet at no notice whatsoever was clearly quite a difficult thing to experience, especially just before Christmas. Thanks a bunch.
Were you given any reasons why, you know, for you personally, you didn't feel like you'd been doing your job?
No, the email that Marvin sent to Ellen says I've got no complaints with Fee's work. It's simply that the other political parties are not playing ball, basically. So, you know, slightly at a loss to know exactly what his problem is.
Before you were doing energy and waste, you were doing health, which is obviously very important. Just tell us a little bit about that portfolio and what you think you managed to achieve doing that.
Well, the health portfolio was quite difficult, because obviously you're working with other agencies, notably the NHS and with the CCG and all the rest of it. And the biggest thing that we faced at the time was what's called the Sustainable STP, the Sustainable Transformation Programme. And if it's one thing I've learned over the last few years, whenever you see the word transformation, you reach for your handgun, frankly, because it generally means cuts in some... I don't mean handgun literally, obviously. You know, before anyone takes that the wrong way. But, you know, transformation in, you know, new speak now means cuts. And that was what was being implemented throughout the NHS and
it's
bits
like
of adult social care.
Regeneration means demolition.
Yes, it does a bit, yeah. Yeah, but transformation, generally speaking, does mean cuts in some variety. And there were millions and millions of pounds of the cuts being proposed across the southwest. And I think what I find difficult about this, whatever your arguments around Marvin implementing the cuts that are otherwise in Bristol, the language that goes with this is people aren't saying we're making cuts, they're saying they're transforming. There's a sort of pretense that things can be done better with less, that we're going to do things differently, we're going to do things differently in the world to be a better place as a result, when in fact I think there's a certain honesty in saying, I'm sorry, we haven't got any money, you're going to get fewer services than they used to, rather than dressing it up in the language of transformation.
What about these STP aspect, which is supposed to be, I mean, maybe you can help us here, there's talk of selling off property, NHS-owned property, at cut prices to developers and to anyone else that wants to buy it, effectively.
I don't know what properties that would relate to. I mean, I know there was certainly thinking that services need to be concentrated in fewer buildings. And obviously, a bit like schools, really, in some respects. There is an argument that if you have a bigger place, then you can have better, more, and a greater range of services in a bigger building. However, human nature dictates that a lot of people prefer to have a local hospital or a local school, even if it is smaller. And the services are smaller as well. But so selling buildings off, I don't know. There were definitely moves to reduce the number of buildings that health services were operating out of for efficiency reasons.
And nothing to do with selling them off?
Not that I heard of, but then...
Because
bear in mind, I was on the council side of health. So whilst we had some responsibility for mental health, and what was called tier 2 and 3 services, the kind of emergency services in the hospitals were under the control of the NHS. So it was all very... It was quite a difficult role because a lot was expected, but you have very limited control as someone who works for the council.
I suppose you've witnessed this whole crisis in social care pretty much at first hand.
Well, I think we've all witnessed a crisis in social care. Just need to walk the streets of Broadmead to see the crisis in social care because there's just increasing numbers of people who the system can't cope with anymore. So I think, we all have to a large degree. And I think it's a very, very... I mean, Helen Holland's in charge of this portfolio now, and I think she's got an awful job to do, poor woman. Social care as well. I suspect it's no coincidence that the director of people services in Bristol has announced he's leaving at the beginning of the week, because he's already had one heart attack, and it's a really difficult job. There's fewer and fewer resources for it. We've got an extra couple of percent in council tax money, which is nowhere near enough, and there's only so much you can do with a finite amount of money. And I think we have got to the stage now. I can appreciate that Marvin has attempted a softly approach with government, and we have had some capital funding out of government, but we do need to press, along with other core cities, for greater funding for our social services, because capital costs are one thing, but ongoing social services, the Association of Local Government, they've produced this, it's not called the Association, it's APSI it's called, but they produce this thing called the Graph of Doom, which every local authority is aware of, which shows that by about 2020, we will just about have enough money, if we're lucky, to run children's services and adult social care, but nothing else, absolutely nothing else. And we've got increasing need and reducing funds, and it doesn't take a genius to work out that it just doesn't work.
What about this director that's leaving, John Redman? I mean, most people probably never heard of him. Who is he? What does he do? And why should he stay, if possible?
There used to be four service directors. John was in charge of adult social care, children's social care, schools. It was called the People Directorate, which, again, to people outside of the council, probably doesn't mean too much. But essentially, adults and children's services. And John was incredibly hardworking. He was very well respected within the council, and it was announced on Tuesday, I think, that he's leaving, and his last day is on the 19th of January.
That doesn't give a lot of time to put someone else suitably qualified in place, does it? It's almost like there's a crisis in the crisis itself.
I think there are a lot of concerns in the council. We don't have a lot of service directors left. Nikki Beardmore, she's leaving on the 18th, I think. There's Alison Cumley left, who's in charge of neighbourhoods, and that's it. We've got no chief exec anymore either.
So why the hemorrhaging of top staff? What's happening?
Lots of reasons. I think it is very difficult working in local authorities at the moment because of the squeeze. It must be incredibly dispiriting to do a job that you clearly care about, and to see services crumble away before your very eyes and being continually asked to do more with less. I mean, that must be incredibly difficult. I think as well that the current administration does have a significant level of mistrust of anybody who was associated with the Ferguson administration. That'd be my take on it. So I think there has... Clearly, when you come to the new administration, yes, there's a new broom aspect to things. You want to do things differently.
But not
and you want to
people...
get fresh blood in. But you can have too much of a good thing. And pretty much everybody who was associated with the Ferguson era has now left.
But then not all of them were appointed by Ferguson, surely. He didn't get rid of everybody and bring an entirely new lot in,
what,
surely.
What, George?
Yeah.
No, he didn't. No, no, it's a fair few people.
So some of those people, you're saying, oh, yeah, but you worked for George. Yeah, but then you worked for the administration before that too. So
yeah. No, but see, there is a sense that, I think in the wake of the Bundred report as well, there is a sense that there's not a lot of trust in senior council officers in the current administration, which, you know, nobody's perfect. I'm sure mistakes were made and not everybody was, you know, as good as they might have been. But there are a lot of very experienced, good people within the council who have now left. And I think it's to the council's detriment, to be honest, because there were some very competent, very committed, dedicated officers there. And increasing numbers of them are either leaving or being pushed.
Well, you were talking about seeing social care problems in Broadmead, and businesses have been complaining this week in the Bristol Post about rough sleepers and homeless people in Bristol city centre. It comes after notices were handed out to homeless people to clear out their belongings. Action to clear out rough sleepers from the centre of Bristol had to be halted by council bosses after they found out, it's been claimed. Homeless people on the streets of Broadmead were shocked after receiving official notices from Bristol waste workers on Wednesday morning, January the 10th. Notices came about after several businesses in the city centre complained because people's rough sleeping belongings were scattered around the area. A pressure group called it the worst of social cleansing. Written on official Bristol Waste headed paper, the notice read, "Please be advised, you need to remove all your belongings from the location within the next 24 hours. If you fail to do so, they'll be removed and stored at our depot for 1 week only. If you wish to collect your belongings, you can do so from the following address." The address given was Lewin's Mead Depot in Deep Street. Bristol City Council told the Bristol Post it had not been aware of the notices and halted any action by Bristol Waste after it found out. It added the notices were the decision of Bristol Waste Company rather than the council.
Yeah, news to me as well, quite frankly. I mean, there's no easy solution to what to do with... I mean, clearly there is provision provided by the council via St Mungo's for people who are homeless, but that doesn't suit everybody and not everybody finds it particularly attractive. So I think, you know, Bristol Waste clearly, from what I can pick up anyway, they acted outside of their powers, or they acted certainly without consulting the council about it when they started handing out these notices. And I think perhaps it depends who it was within the business community in Broadmead who was complaining, but they might have been slightly more creative in their solution to the problem.
It seems to be an issue of who owns the land sometimes, whether it's actually a public, Bristol City Council owned street or somewhere like Broadmead, which I'm not sure who owns it, but it may be private companies. Certainly Cabot Circus is privately owned. So maybe this has something to do with who actually owns the land, because this is quite clearly driven by the businesses. And there was what I thought was a terrific article in The Guardian just before Christmas called "Appeasing the Developers. Even Labour-controlled cities keep extent of private public spaces secret." Yeah. And this was an article written by Jack Schenker, Tuesday the 26th of September last year. "Many of Britain's largest cities are refusing to reveal information regarding the private ownership of seemingly public spaces, The Guardian's discovered, fueling concerns about a growing democratic deficit within local city government." Does it really matter who owns a street in the city centre?
Well, I think it doesn't until something goes wrong, and then you hear all these horror stories about people being removed from premises for, you know, fairly minor things. I mean, I don't know who owns Broadmead, I must say, but it suggests to me if Bristol Waste were working there, then it's a Bristol-owned street, but I could be wrong. Cabot Circus, I mean, it's the problem is control over behaviour, and you can get some very... There can be some quite minor. People say with mental health problems, they could be treated quite badly by private security companies on private land, certainly worse than they would be on public land, one would imagine. I mean, it's simply there's more control by private companies on those spaces than they would have otherwise. So it makes me feel a bit nervous, I have to say.
Well, I came across during the week, I think it was Tuesday, walking through the city centre, these three guys. They were Bristol City Council litter officers, and they were waiting for a guy to set up as a busker to wait until he started playing, and then... I don't know whether they were going to go and check his ID or something afterwards. I'm not sure.
I think that the private people, the Kingdom people, from my waste days, I know a bit about this. They're not they are hired by Bristol City Council, but they are an independent company and they pretty much do litter enforcement. They don't have any other powers around busking. We have got new busking rules that's been introduced, actually, which means that you can busk for a certain length of time and then you have to move on. Interestingly, in London, interesting fact, you can busk for an hour in London unless you're playing the bagpipes, in which case it's half an hour, which I think is fair enough, really.
It is.
Yeah, but the Kingdom guys, they
would have been... they just move across the road and start again somewhere else?
I don't know.
That's what I do.
Location. Yes, yes. I don't know. I'll give it a go. You never know. I need a job at the moment. So
anyway, yeah. my tweet I did. Because basically, I took a photo of these three guys from behind, so you couldn't see their faces or anything. I thought, oh, that'd be fine. They won't mind about that with this busker setting up in the background. They sort of seem to be loitering there, so I used that word in my tweet. And when I'd taken the photographs, I started walking off. But one of the guys then came towards me and started following me. Said, "You can't take my photograph, and if you do put it on Twitter or on Facebook, we're going to sue you." So I thought, that's a little bit... Why is that? His name is Officer Ellis. His photograph's been in the Bristol Post several times. So, of course, I tweeted it, and I put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's now got over 100 retweets and literally scores and scores and scores of comments, and various people... really usefully adding things like that Guardian article saying, "Hey, have a look at this. This might have something to do with it," you know, and commenting on the idea that you apparently can't take a photograph of these guys.
Yeah,
I don't believe it personally.
I complain directly to Kingdom about that one because that doesn't sound right to me. I'm not a lawyer. However, I mean, I would say in their defence, their job is to loiter around looking out for people dropping. So that their job is technically to loiter in Broadmead. No, to make sure people don't litter the place. However, not being able to take the photograph does seem peculiar, and I would suggest you complain to Kingdom about it.
I think I just tweeting has done the job, I think, in a way, but just showing that, yes, it can go onto Facebook, and if they want to see me in court, quite a lot of people retweeted it saying, "Oh dear, I've just retweeted it too, you'll have to take me to court as well."
It's going to be a busy day in court.
It is. Anyway, what do you make of this whole idea? Because the thing is, there's things can happen in the city centre, which it's actually quite useful to maybe even film if you've got a camera, say an altercation or whatever. Usually the police are fine about this.
Yeah, there would be. I mean, that's why so many cyclists wander around with not GoPros, but GoPro equivalents on their helmets, because they want to have evidence if they get knocked over by somebody. I mean, as far as I'm aware, you're totally at liberty to film whoever you want in the city centre, unless it's kind of the Secret Services or the Queen or whatever. Might even the Queen you could probably record, couldn't you? I mean, the Kingdom people, they're not... They are licensed to operate on council land and elsewhere as well. So I know that they're going to be... They started off in Broadmead, but they're going to be spreading their activities to other bits of the city that where litter is a problem.
Bristolian, bless them, you know. The paper pointed out that they've been... those jobs were offered at £8 an hour, and yet what they called the Reverend Marvin Rees's formal living wage rate for all council workers and contractors is £8.45 an hour. So how come these guys are being paid less than the minimum Bristol City Council's own enforced for contractors' wage?
Got a clue.
I know.
Sorry.
Martin Summers, let's bring you in on this. I mean, this whole thing of photographing in city centres, I'm sure you're not an expert on it, but it does seem a little bit like it's being slowly privatised.
Well, I mean, there is a problem with the privatisation of public space, which we've covered on this show many times. I mean, public spaces, we ought to defend the right of publics. For example, you might want to protest about something, and that's what a public space is for.
There's a book by Anna Minton called Ground Control, and she came to talk at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft a couple of years ago, absolutely jam-packed, fascinating area. In fact, it's a form of, a lot of people say, the enclosures. You know, when people were kicked out of their land in the hundreds of years ago, this whole process, the privatisation, is now moving right into the centre of our cities and right here in Bristol too. Anyway, Fee, I just wonder what you're doing now, because you used to have quite a lot to do, I imagine, at the Cabinet.
I did. Yeah, well, I was fairly busy. It was pretty much a full-time job, believe it or not. Well, I'm still a city councillor, so bad luck, people of Redland. You're stuck with me for the next couple of years yet. I'm now chairing Public Safety and Protection as well, so I'm looking after taxi drivers in the city, which is, you know, an extra bit because of all the political shuffling as a result of me and Claire being kicked out. Labour Party people had to give up a couple of chairs. So I'm now chairing Public Safety and Protection, but... Yes, I've got a fair bit of time on my hands. Nice to see you. I can spare it now.
Martin, what's your verdict on this whole idea of getting rid of the Rainbow Cabinet?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is in other core cities, you've got the Labour Party in charge and there is no coalition. Bristol is unique in having that. And I think in many ways I wasn't happy when the Labour Party went into coalition with George, but I kind of accepted it because it seemed like the best solution to the problems. And I've kind of accepted it as well for the new setup. You know, we might as well continue with it. Because the fact of the matter is that the problems we face are not to do with party politics in Bristol. It's to do with the lack of money, etc. So if you have a rainbow coalition, you've got a better chance of squeezing some money out of the government.
It's also a broader range of opinion. And yeah. I think, you know, we all make mistakes from time to time. And I think that even the Labour administration might occasionally get it wrong. And it's useful to have someone in there who can point that out.
Well, indeed. But also, I think to have a rainbow administration and decide you don't want one, okay, I can buy that if that's the direction we're going in, but I don't think there was any real discussion about it. No. This is what's worrying: is that it's just an arbitrary decision, where there's not been. I mean, politically, for example, you could have said, right, we're going to push the Tories out because they're the ones who want the cuts. And therefore, you know, but keeping them in was quite useful. So Claire presumably went up to London with the rest of them to try and knock on the government's door. And that's part of the strategy of keeping them in. On the other hand, we've had people on this show suggesting, well, if we've got cuts to make in Bristol, let's make them in Tory wards and make sure people who vote Tory in those wards lose their libraries because they want cuts.
Big, I suppose, national story this week is Theresa May's, what the Huffington Post calls, a botched cabinet reshuffle. They say it confirms the Prime Minister's weakness. Justin Greening quits as the Conservatives accidentally announce a new party chairman. That's one I'd missed. They actually tweeted out the new party chairman was going to be Chris Grayling, and then all of a sudden changed their mind. Is someone, I think, a little bit more obscure than that now. There's lots of changes in the sort of lower ranks, but not at the higher ranks. And I think Martin Summers, that's why they're saying that this is a sign of Theresa May's weakness, because, for example, she's not been able to move the man responsible for all the failures in the National Health Service, Jeremy Hunt, and other senior cabinet members.
Well, I think the fact that Hunt was brought in to be sacked and managed to walk out, not only not sacked, but also taking over adult social care.
So I understand, yeah.
And I think idea behind that is that the correct me if I'm wrong, Fee, that the NHS is going to take over adult social care rather than local authorities. Is that the implication?
The last I heard was there'd be increasing numbers of accountable care associations or accountable care bodies where funds from the council related to social care and the NHS would be pooled in order to do things like unblock beds. Because at the moment I don't know what the situation is in Bristol, but this is as a general principle, I think there's moves in several authorities towards increased pooling of funds between the NHS and the local council. Because otherwise you get, you know, the council saying, not deliberately, but they don't have the funds to pay for people's social care beds when they come out of hospital, so people get bed blocked, and it's just a nonsense.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would
so
argue
there's a certain virtue for
I
it.
I would argue that it makes sense as a top-down socialist for the NHS to run that rather than local.
Yeah,
local authorities.
I don't think it's looking at the NHS running it. I think they're looking at pooling the resources and having the grey area in between.
Okay,
the bits,
well, I mean, but you know. I mean, there's bound to be a problem when you've got two different organisations based on a different structure deciding on something.
And
like
both
that.
Of them are sort of huge Soviet structures as well. Not they, and they're massive.
Well,
so
exactly.
It's hard,
I mean, but the point is that if the NHS, just imagine, thought experiment, if the NHS was responsible for social care completely, then they would make plans for beds. You know, the resources would be channeled through them, and so on. I mean, the problem with local authorities is they've got lots of other things to do, and you know, there's bound to be differences in the way they approach it.
And each one of NHS and local authorities are all, but you know, they're trying to save, shove the blame for the problem onto the other organisation.
Yeah.
That's one of the main problem, I think. Anyway, so yes, it was Brandon Lewis was it who actually ended up being Tory Party chairman, and not Chris Grayling as they initially announced. But the wonder of Twitter, some people obviously kept the original tweet, and so you can see this false announcement, false bit of fake news sent out on Twitter, but just by Donald Trump this week, but also by the Conservative Party. Also, Justine Greening was told she was going to have to take over the Department for Work and Pensions, former Education Secretary, and she refused, saying, I mean, I think this must have something to do with all the problems there's been over universal credit, and so she's resigned because she was basically seeing that as an almost impossible department to run. And who was it came along and said, it's okay, Captain, I'll do it? Esther McVeigh, good old Esther McVeigh, who got booted out by the electorate in Liverpool in the 2015 general election, but then was given George Osborne's old seat, Tatton. So she's back in the Houses of Parliament, and if you remember her, she was the one behind the bedroom tax and behind the getting rid of the personal independence payments. And so she's now running the Department for Work and Pensions. A lot of people suggesting that this is quite worrying appointment. So anyway, I thought what we'd do is we'd go back to 2013 when Esther McVeigh was getting on the nerves of so many disabled people and have a listen to a conversation she had with the BBC's Tony Livesey about the effects of some of her ministerial changes at the time.
So what you're saying is a lot of people on the benefit at the moment don't deserve it.
I never said that at all, and I would never say that.
Well, you have, because you're going to cut 170,000 claimants, Esther, so no. If they don't deserve it, then how are you going to cut them?
No, that isn't right, and I really don't like this, you know, inflammatory language, what you're doing. What's happened is the number of people on this benefit has increased by 40% in the last 10 years. You're viewing this as a static benefit. It isn't that. Some people do get better, so they wouldn't remain on this benefit. There's 3.3 million people on it now, and like I said, in a year, time, a third of people who've had a condition would get better. So we expect movement. That happens now. People have fixed term, benefits. That is what happened. That will continue to be so.
Are you? Let's distinguish here between perhaps allowance for sickness and allowance for disability. Are you saying 170,000 people who were previously disabled are now going to get better?
That's right. All of the statistics show that a third of the people with conditions who might have had illness, might have been in hospital, might have had many things, whether it could have been, you know, mental problems there or physical problems, will get better in the year.
That was from 2013, talking to Tony Livesey on the BBC. Esther McVeigh is now Department for Work and Pensions Secretary. I wonder what my guests, Fee and Martin, make of this idea of one-third of disabled people getting better, because certainly the disabled campaigners at the time and since have been absolutely livid with Esther McVeigh and with this new appointment.
Yeah, I mean, people do get better, clearly, but I think what we're looking at the moment is a massive surge in, 50% of sickness benefits are paid to people with mental health problems or musculoskeletal problems, so, you know, aches and pain, backache mainly, that sort of thing, which are long and intractable, and I cannot see either of those statistics getting any better, quite frankly, especially the mental health stuff, because we have, you know, we've got universal credit coming in, we've got all sorts of austerity measures flown around, and that does not do people's mental health much good. So I genuinely do not see how people's general health is going to be improved by the current political climate.
What about Esther McVeigh, Martin?
Well, I mean, if you think Justine Greening was going to head up this department, that was the plan, because she's got a reputation of being a sort of thinking Tory of a slightly more, you know, she was against grammar schools, for example, which is why she was going to be moved. Mm. But of course, now they've put a hardliner in. It sort of messes up the politics of it, because Justine Greening was quite rightly saying, well, I don't want to front up for this, because this is almost from a previous era of Tory strategy, which is picking on people on benefits, because they know that the majority of these people are concentrated in inner city constituencies and so on, where they're not going to make a difference politically. It's all to do with the electoral system.
Oh, yeah,
they know, their focus groups have looked at what people embarking on a certain level of income will buy into. And it's been quite successful, and they showed on the opinion focus groups were showing that even people on benefits thought that people on benefits had too much benefit.
But what's so wicked about all of this is that they're not actually saving any money either.
No, it's
ideological.
Do with the psychology and ideology of it. That's right. And of course, if there was and a changed electoral system, every vote would count. And in the inner cities, if we piled up votes there, they wouldn't be wasted votes. The electoral system allows the scapegoating of the poor and the vulnerable, because if you want to win, you've got to convince the know-nothing middle about what's going on, and they are actually there is actually a drumbeat in the Tory press every day. These people are scroungers, bang bang bang, and it just goes on and on and on.
Okay, we just want to mention another story to do with the health service now. NHS patients dying in hospital corridors, A&E doctors tell Theresa May. Doctors are running 68 A&E departments have told the Prime Minister patients are dying prematurely because staff are too busy to treat them. Now, this is basically patients queuing up in corridors. A&E units are under such intense strain that patients are at an intolerable risk of being harmed by receiving poor care. Specialists in emergency medicine from 68 hospitals have told the Prime Minister in a letter of unprecedented alarm. In recent weeks, some hospitals became so overloaded they were looking after as many as 120 patients a day in corridors, with some dying prematurely as a result. So let's have a listen. This was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week. Let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn asking the Prime Minister Theresa May about the health service.
Gerald Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituency office and local citizens' advice bureau are receiving ever-increasing complaints about PIP claims. Assessments are being refused.
Oh, this is disability, sorry.
5% of claims are overturned on appeal at tribunal. Growing number of appeals means that tribunals are taking longer, anything between 4 and 7 months. Can I ask the Prime Minister if she agrees that the PIP assessment process is fundamentally flawed and what action she can take to avoid unnecessary expense of court and, more importantly, the undue stress and hardship being caused to my constituents and those across the country?
Well, I understand the point that the Honourable Gentleman is making about ensuring, as we want to, that these assessments are being conducted as well as they can and that people are getting the awards that they are in fact should be getting and that they're entitled to. In fact, since we introduced the personal independence payment, we've carried out around 2.9 million assessments. 8% of those have been appealed, but only 4% of those decisions are changed following an appeal. And in the majority of cases, it's because new evidence is presented at the appeal than was presented when the original case was being put forward. But of course, the Department for Work and Pensions continues to look at ensuring that when these assessments are made, they are done properly and that people get the right results.
Yes, that was about the personal independence payments, which I seem to remember Esther McVeigh banned, and then some people took her to court, and the High Court or Supreme Court overturned the getting rid of the... maybe it was a particular fund. Anyway, that was for disabled people. There's lots on this on the Triangle website, I think it's called, which is about basically by disabled rights campaigners. Anyway, 7 comments by Esther McVeigh that led to her to be called an alarming choice for Tory benefits chief. If you're one of millions of Brits who claims benefits, it's fair to say you can get used to hearing the name Esther McVeigh. She said the rise of food banks was positive. She said benefit sanctions help people find work and compared claimants to school children. She vowed to take 300,000 people's disability benefits away, saying bodies heal. I'm not quite sure what she meant by that. But she said job seekers would be sanctioned for refusing a 0 hours contract. She said that there was no robust evidence that linked soaring food bank use to welfare cuts. She repeatedly defended the bedroom tax. And finally, she said success is nothing to do with luck. So what's she really saying there? It's almost like at that final comment, that's quite eerie. It's nothing to do with luck. It's just because people haven't tried hard enough. That's why they're on benefits.
We're back to the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, really, aren't we? Which I think you might have touched on earlier on. I mean, my experience of dealing with, because as you know, I used to be an MP's caseworker, so I spent a lot of my time dealing with people who's been wrongly assessed. I mean, one classic example is somebody who'd lost their leg in a motorcycle accident. They were assessed at one level and they were reassessed a year later and they were told they weren't quite as disabled. And it was like, well, his leg's still not there. What are you on about? I mean, it was, and the number of sheer cack-handed, vicious misjudgments that happened. I mean, it's very, very difficult for people to get... I mean, thank goodness for people like Avon and Bristol Law Centre and various other legal entities who help people out with their benefits claims, because it's really, really difficult, if you're not well in the first place, to go through all of the, you know, all the bureaucracy and the turmoil of trying to appeal a judgment. It's really, really difficult.
Martin, several thousand people were sacked. Disabled people were sacked when Esther McVeigh got rid of Remploy, which was set up by Winston Churchill after the Second World War as well.
Well, that just shows the hypocrisy, doesn't it? You've got actually supported employment for disabled people, which they get rid of, and then say, why haven't you got a job? And the other thing I would say on this is another rather important point. Why is anybody other than a medical doctor making decisions about whether people are fit for work or not? It's just not right.
Okay,
well, quite often the opinions of a medical doctor were sought, they were written down and completely ignored in favour of the
assessor.
Well,
that's no good at all.
I
think
perverse,
that's absolutely
frankly.
Right. What is this, the Burma Railway? Yeah. Is it the guards who decide who's ill or not, or is it the doctors?
Let's get on to the NHS now. On Wednesday, this is Prime Minister Theresa May answering a question from Jeremy Corbyn.
This is what NHS providers said only last week. Preparations for winter in the NHS have been more extensive and meticulous than ever before.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Mr. Speaker, we all thank all NHS staff for what they do, but the reality is that the 55,000 operations cancelled means that those 55,000 people join the already 4 million waiting for operations within the NHS. Perhaps the Prime Minister could listen to the experience of Vicky. Her 82-year-old mother spent 13 hours on a trolley in a corridor. That was on top of the 3 hours between her first calling 999 and arriving at hospital. Vicky says, and I quote, "A volunteer first responder from Warwickshire Heart Service, whose day job is in the army, kept mum safe until paramedics arrived." Her mother then suffered a heart attack just a week before. This is not an isolated case. Does the Prime Minister really believe the NHS is better prepared than ever for the crisis it's now going through?
First of all, can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that nobody wants to hear people having to experience what Vicky and her mother had experienced. And of course, we need to ensure that we learn from these incidents, and that's exactly what we do in the National Health Service. And I'm very happy to ensure that that particular case is looked at, if he would like to provide me with the details of that particular case. But week in and week out in the run-up to Christmas and now today, what the Right Honourable Gentleman is doing is giving an impression of a National Health Service that is failing everybody that goes to use the NHS. The reality in our NHS is that we are seeing 2.9 million more people now going to accident and emergency. We're seeing over 2 million more operations taking place each year. Our National Health Service is something that we should be proud of, and that's why it's a first-class National Health Service, a first-class National Health Service that has been identified as the number one health system in the world. That means it's a better health system than Australia, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Canada, Switzerland, Sweden, France, Germany, and the United States of America.
That's true. It was the Commonwealth Fund, I think, that proved that. She's actually got that slightly wrong. It's the most cost-efficient in the world. They have better outcomes in places like France and Germany, but they spend a lot more money. Yep. Because the non-insurance basis of the National Health Service has always been something that people like Jeremy Hunt, who wrote a book about dismantling the health service, have always hated. But, of course, what the real problem, to my mind, is the NHS trusts are run by managers, and, of course, they haven't got enough beds. There used to be redundancy in the old top-down system, so the hospitals would often have empty beds because you'd have more beds than you needed, just in case something happened. But of course, when you start thinking in terms of running it like a business, then you actually try to do just-in-time bed supply. And of course, it doesn't work like that. It's not a business.
Fee, before we hear from you on that, National Health Service is no longer able to meet the standards in its constitution. Health boss tells Jeremy Hunt, who was reappointed as Health Secretary this week, amazingly. The National Health Service is a watershed moment and cannot deliver care to the standards required by its constitution. Chris Hopson, Chief Executive of NHS Providers, which acts as a bridge between trusts and the Department of Health, has written to the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care a call for extra investment in a long-term basis to address the fragility of the wider NHS. So apparently no longer meeting the standards in its constitution. So what's the point of having those standards?
Yeah, I don't know what the standards in the constitution are. I mean, certainly when I was doing health and wellbeing, I did go to the hospitals on several occasions. And what I was told, was reflecting on what you were saying, Martin, was that on a motorway, if you've got, 100% occupancy, the motorway doesn't move, does it, of cars? And it's a similar thing, you need to have a bit of slack in there to keep things moving. And it's exactly the same with the NHS. And, the BRI, they're looking at bed occupancy upwards of 95%, which means that nothing moves. And clearly, I mean, the doctors I talked to said, yes, obviously we can do things differently. I'm sure there are efficiencies that can be made, but we need to hang on to the savings from those efficiencies and we need further investments. And for to turn around and say there's been a massive increase in people going to A&E, well, I wonder why that is. Have you tried getting a doctor's appointment around here? Yeah. It takes 2 weeks at the very least, if you're lucky.
That's right.
And you need to call before 9 a.m. to get a 2-week appointment. Otherwise, they've all gone for that day.
So
you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work that one out.
No, it doesn't. I think they just need some more money, that's all. Yeah. And maybe there's reasons why they're really destroying the National Health Service just to allow these big American healthcare companies to start doing private health insurance. Anyway, then let's have a little look at teaching now, because a question was asked about that. Far less people applying to be teacher training courses.
Prime Minister, you say there's a plan. Let me tell you.
I'm sorry, I seem to be getting a few wrong things this week. Let's just try that again.
Thelma Walker!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was a teacher and a head teacher for 34 years, so I know that I speak on behalf of thousands of teachers and support staff when I ask Prime Minister, in light of the recent announcement of a fall in teacher training application numbers by a third, will the government listen to professionals and fully and fairly fund our schools and colleges, end the toxic culture of targets and tests, deliver a broad and balanced curriculum, and most of all, return the joy of teaching and learning back to our classrooms.
Can I say to the Honourable Lady that we are putting record sums of money into our schools? We are ensuring, but more than that, we're ensuring that we're seeing increasing standards in our schools. That's why today there are 1.9 million more children in good or outstanding schools than in 2010, and I hope she would welcome that.
Well, I mean, on the issue of why people don't want to go into teaching, it's because, I mean, I've been in schools for the last few years now, and when you see really hard-working people crying in the supplies cupboard because they are, you know, fear for their job. I mean, people who've been there for years and have really experienced teachers fear for their jobs if you get an Ofsted inspection. And you can just be cast overboard, even if you've been 30 years in education.
Is there any difference between the council still council-run schools and the privatised ones?
Well, I think the system has become a dog's breakfast. There used to be a, you know, everybody knew where they stood and everybody knew what was going on. But of course, what you've now got is it's been turned into a market. And of course, indirectly, it's a pseudo market. It's all paid for by taxpayers. But what then tends to happen is in markets, somebody has to fail. And the whole thing of fail, the idea of, my father used to be a head teacher for 30 years. And what made him snort with derision is when they brought in the thing that being a satisfactory school was no longer good enough. That's absurd.
Mm. Well, my mum was a teacher, so there we are. But I've also got two kids in secondary schools in Bristol myself, and I think one of the things that's sapping the very lifeblood out of any kind of enjoyment of learning is the continual testing. I mean, my eldest is part of the cohort doing the GCSEs this year, which is the new curriculum. And no wonder mental health problems in young people are going through the roof, because the pressure they're under, the pressure the teachers are under to make them perform and to jump through these hoops and learn stuff. I mean, some of the GCSE maths now, it is way up to A-level standard. The teachers don't know what's in the exam papers. The kids are terrified. It's just an awful, depressing situation.
But isn't this just a general technique that they're trying to raise the bar for each age child? They're trying to get them to learn a little bit higher age stuff to try and get them ahead, and I suppose find out who are the really brightest kids
and give them a better education. Certainly working out which kids can do the most rote learning. I mean, there's certainly no time for inquiry. There's no time for exploration, and they all hate it. They all hate every single subject, and that's really not a good learning outcome. And you may come out with children with, like, if you've got kids who come out with 12 GCSEs, all well and good, but if they're so socially anxious and they're self-harming, that's no good to society or the individuals themselves.
Martin,
it really is awful.
Your quick 15-second fix for this.
Well, just get rid of the testing regime. In Finland, they don't do any tests at all until they're 18 years old. They do one big one, and they've got the best results in Europe.
Okay, the Grenfell Tower fire. KPMG, the wonderful auditors, have quit the inquiry amid conflict of interest furore. This is on the BBC website. KPMG is the auditor of three of the firms under scrutiny by the inquiry into the tower block blaze, in which 71 people died on the 14th of June last year. We're going to be hearing from Joe Delaney in a minute, who I spoke to earlier this week. He's one of the people who was helping the bloggers who were blogging in November 2016, 6-7 months before the fire, saying that unless there's some total disaster here, no one is going to notice what this mini mafia are up to that are running our estate. And of course they were proved right. But how is it, Fee and then Martin, how is it that KPMG could be appointed as auditors to an inquiry where other firms that they audit are under investigation?
I've got no, I mean, I can't speak for Kensington and Chelsea Council because, you know, I clearly don't work for them. But KPMG do seem to be the sort of external consultants of choice. I mean, they're quite heavily involved in the Mayor's City office, I think. So, yeah.
Who audits them, I wonder? Is it PricewaterhouseCoopers? And then maybe KPMG audits PricewaterhouseCoopers?
I don't know.
Martin, how does a firm that's auditing the companies under investigation get appointed to the inquiry, whereas actually quite a lot of people who were in the tower have been told, no, you can't be in the inquiry directly?
Well, as you know, Tony, the Pat Finucane Centre in Belfast have always opposed British inquiries because of the Inquiries Act of 2005, I think it is. They were always a whitewash. If you think of the original Bloody Sunday inquiry and so on, they want an inquiry into collusion between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitaries over 20, 30 years. But they don't want a British inquiry. They want an international inquiry because they don't believe British inquiries are independent. And I think that this is actually a whitewash inquiry. It's increasingly becoming.
Well, we shall see. Certainly, people involved in it very much hope it doesn't turn out like Hillsborough. And they've been talking to the people from Hillsborough to make sure of that, at least to do their best to make sure of it. But anyway, so here's Joe Delaney from, he's been involved with the Grenfell Action Group, and here he is talking about the bloggers that originally predicted this fire back in November 2016, and also the cladding and who potentially might be arrested by the police for the fire. In November the 20th, 2016, which was about 7 months before the fire, the Grenfell Action Group posted a blog entitled, with a headline, Playing with Fire. They say in that that only a catastrophic event will expose the ineptitude and incompetence of our landlord, KCTMO. They also say a serious fire in a tower block is the most likely reason that those who wield power at KCTMO will be found out and brought to justice. They talk about these landlords as being evil and being unprincipled and being a mini mafia, Joe. They say a future major disaster is likely to happen. And also they say only an incident that results in serious loss of life of KCTMO residents will allow external scrutiny to shine a light on the malign governance of KCTMO. Now, this sounds to me almost like a direct warning saying that this fire could happen, and we believe it will happen. And I find it incredible that 7 months before, this can have been publicly circulated, and yet nothing was done, it seems, to make sure that it couldn't happen.
But Tony, the thing is, something was done, because what KCTMO, Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation, we call it the TMO locally, what the TMO and the council were doing at the time was slagging off Francis O'Connor, the author of the blog, and slagging off Eddie Dufan, the guy who, the other co-author of the blog. Type of cladding, remember, it's a public procurement exercise. And so because it's public procurement, any project that's more than £154,000 has to go out to public tender. Now, the tender documents for the regeneration of that block specified one type of cladding. It was RBKC staff who made it, well, one of the councillors there, Councillor Rockfield in Mellon, who made the arbitrary decision when he was trying to shave costs on this project to change the type of cladding that was used. So instead of using Celotex FR, which is Celotex fire resistant, they decided to use Celotex SR, you know, which saved them a couple of thousand quid. on this. When it comes to stuff, you know, should Ryden have said at the time, well, look, we don't believe that this is a suitable type of equipment, you know, perhaps they should have done. But I mean, I can't really comment on that because I don't know. I don't know enough about that area to say so. But ultimately, I mean, it's the one, you know, he who pays the piper, I think, is the one who should be held ultimately accountable.
Yeah, well, that's one view from someone that lived very close to Grenfell and was involved and has been involved in the Grenfell Action Group. Now, Fee, we're talking about a couple of £1,000, 70 people lost their lives. Well, is it acceptable for the local residents to be complaining about this publicly, then to be attacked, actually threatened with legal action by the council for saying that they were a mini-mafia, when it turns out, at the end of the day, perhaps they were?
Well, clearly not. I mean, I think, just to reassure people, I think there's been fairly extensive inspections taken on social housing in Bristol, and we haven't encountered any similar problems here, so thankfully. But yes, clearly this was a very unpleasant situation, and I can only feel for the people who are involved, who sat there crying wolf, as it were, and no one believed them.
70 people dead, Martin. They saved £2,000.
Yeah, and I think the actual decision to make the cladding needs to be thought about as well, because it's an old-style 70s concrete block, and you've got lots of very nice property around there, and having a big eyesore concrete block in the middle of it was lowering property values. Whereas if we put some nice, colourful cladding on it, then that will help the property prices.
There's an issue of insulation as well.
Well, there is, but at the same time...
With my energy hat on, I've got to say, insulation good.
Yes, I know, but at the same time, not having fireproof cladding is simply... Yeah, that's not just cutting corners. It's bonkers. And the fire brigade was saying afterwards it was a perfect fire with that cladding on it. Absolutely perfect.
We've also seen
not suitable for anything over a certain height. It says in the actual stuff when you buy it, don't put it on a building over three stories.
So watch out, Rock Fielding Mellon. You may get your collar felt, and in many ways I hope he does at least get interviewed at the very least by the police. Anyway, UCL are investigating a eugenics conference secretly held on campus, which was attended by Toby Young. He was a prominent attendee of last year's conference run by honorary senior lecturer at the London University on eugenics. And this is one of the main reasons why it seems why he was sacked from his top university job, Toby Young was. What do you make of this story, Fee?
Oh, he's a lovely man, isn't he, Toby Young? I mean, the delightful comments he made about people from working class backgrounds going to university, that was a bit of a corker, wasn't it? What do you call it, a disease or something? I mean, really. You know, I mean, it's a bit the kind of, he's like a male Katie Hopkins in some way. Okay, he makes a living out of making, you know, incendiary remarks, but he really shouldn't be included in government in any way. It's ridiculous.
Well, I think the other thing that people are missing is what is this Office for Students supposed to do?
Well, yeah,
it's a whole new thing. There's no money for anything, but we've got a whole new Office for Students, and it's a jobs for our chums who actually have all these silly little opinions. And, of course, they've come a cropper on this, as they may come a cropper with Esther McVeigh on the DWP.
Well, the London Student magazine has pointed out that there are neo-Nazi links to this conference, as you might expect, with the eugenicists and also people at the conference who advocate raping children. And yet, he didn't do, Toby Young didn't do any kind of sort of expose of this. He was just sort of dipping in to see if there was anything of use. And then he actually came out with something to do with eugenics that could possibly be used on working class people. So, I mean, what is eugenics?
Well, I mean, eugenics is the idea that you should basically try and program the genetic pool of the population. And it used to be quite popular, of course, in socialist Sweden, dare I say it.
And in socialist
in
Britain. In nice and socialist
I mean,
Britain,
you know, people like H.T. Wells and so on were interested in the sort of improvement of the race.
Wasn't
sort of
Bertrand
thing.
Russell quite interested in it as well?
Well, I think it's the sort of thing that got a very bad name after Nazi Germany tried to carry out some of the proposals.
Not
and, of course, in Sweden, quite a lot of people were sterilised. By reforming government.
The implication here, Fee, is that people don't have jobs because they're stupid and therefore their genetic makeup needs to be enhanced.
So the implication where? Sorry, I was blowing my nose there.
Martin.
Well, sorry. I mean, the idea... I mean, he's got very right-wing, pronounced right-wing views. He's made his career on that.
It's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest, Green Councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Join us after the news. We do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.
Live from the Sky News Centre.